The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome, everyone, to Conspiranormal. We are slowly rounding out the rest of the year. And unfortunately, this evening, it doesn't look like Sir Fiel is going to be able to join us. But I have pulled in Mr. Chris Corey, who you guys know has been on the show many, many times before. And he's going to join us tonight. Hello, Chris.
Hello. Thank you for having me. Sir Fiel is irreplaceable, but...
That is true. He is unreplaceable and irreplaceable. Absolutely. But the reason I got Chris on primarily is because we're talking to our guest tonight, return guest, Maxim Furyk, about the Philadelphia experiment. And I know, Chris, you are super into the Philadelphia experiment and the Montauk stuff. So we might get into a little bit of that as well.
Yeah, I think one sort of comes out of the other, huh?
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. But welcome, Maxim. Welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thanks, Adam. Great to be here. Hi, Chris. And thanks for giving me the opportunity to talk to your listeners and talk a little bit about the Philadelphia experiment. You know, this 2023 is the 80-year anniversary of the Philadelphia experiment. So it's been getting a little bit of, attention again, as it should, you know, because it fits into that whole paranormal and UFO mystique. So it's good to be talking about it.
Yeah, let's kind of just get into it. I mean, you know, I have heard about the Philadelphia experiment for most of my life. And of course, there was I don't know if you call it famous, but there was a movie that I watched many, many times as a kid and as a teenager called The Philadelphia Experiment. That I really enjoyed, and I think plays a little bit into the surrounding kind of mythology of the Philadelphia experiment. But let's kind of get into the basics of it and what happened or what people think happened and how the story kind of develops.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I mean, you mentioned the motion picture. That was 1984.
Yeah.
And, there were, I think, three motion pictures, two with Michael Perry. And there was a documentary, but I think most people remember those really graphic scenes where these sailors were trapped inside the fused bulkheads of the ship, and they were still alive. And just as that was part of the negative consequences of the Philadelphia experiment. So, you know, it starts there with that Hollywood display. And I think everybody starts there with the Philadelphia experiment. But in actuality, what we believe is that during World War II, you know, the government, the military was doing everything they could to win the war. We know about the Manhattan Project, and Oppenheimer this year was such a big hit at the box office. We know that people like Enrico Fermi were working underneath the University of Chicago, working on his plutonium rods and, trying to trigger some sort of a chain reaction to help out with the Manhattan Project. So there's all these experiments going on, including the Philadelphia experiment. And that allegedly took place on October of 1943, where they were conducting an experiment, And according to this legend, this mythology, the USS Eldridge, destroyer escort, was teleported from Philadelphia Navy Yard to Norfolk and back. And that's the basic premise of the Philadelphia experiment.
Okay. And what were they trying to do? What was the experiment supposed to have been for?
I'm relatively certain that it actually took place. I mean, so with all these things, there's kernels of or piles of truth, and then there's a conjecture. But what was happening during World War II, the Germans had devised these bombs that would sit at the bottom of the ocean. When Allied shipping would go over the bombs, the magnetic current, which is gauged in an element called Gauss, as they would go over these bombs, that magnetic current would go and trigger the bomb and blow up these ships. So the Allies invented a degaussing technique where they would wrap coils around these ships, and they would go and use the electricity to go and nullify the magnetic pull. And it would make the ship not invisible to the naked eye, but would make them invisible to the bombs that were underneath there. So that was a common technique that they used. Supposedly in 1943, it went sideways. They were using too much electricity. Maybe they were doing this, you know, purposely, but allegedly the negative consequences, you know, their people died. People were fused in the in the metal, people suffered, psychosis, just a whole lot of crazy things. And just when we thought that, you know, this whole thing was over, in steps around 1995, steps Al Belak, and he gave us part two of the Philadelphia experiment. Just when we thought it was over and done with, and that was it, you know, so
right.
There was more to the story.
Right. Well, you talk about it in your book, and I want to definitely get into Carlos Allende.
Yeah.
Known as Carl Allen.
Worst
K. Jessup, and that's kind of the, in a way, the beginning of it. But you talk about someone in Coal Region Hoodoo that I've never heard of as part of this, and that is Frederick G. Tracy. And
right, yeah.
This is someone that, from what I read today about this, it seems like there is some plausibility to something actually happening. What happened with him?
Well, a couple of things. One, if we're going to talk about somebody like Al Belak, we should also talk about people like Fred Tracy.
Yeah.
And my cousin, James Furyk, you know, he was a Vietnam vet. He was a medic. And he was good friends with Fred Tracy. They both were living up in Derry, New Hampshire. So cousin Jim told me about this guy, Fred Tracy, that knew about the Philadelphia experiment. So Jim comes back down to Pennsylvania and tells me, calls him up. I start talking to Fred Tracy. And at some point I drove up there. I spent a weekend with him taking pictures and interviewing him. But Fred Tracy claimed that he was on the he was a military guy. He was aboard on the USS Antietam. It was an aircraft carrier. He claimed that they did degaussing experiments on the Antietam, and that the men suffered. There were a lot of negative consequences, almost like radiation sickness. So that was the one thing. So we know that those experiments were happening, and it wasn't just in Philadelphia. The other thing, though, towards the end of World War II, Fred Tracy claimed that Admiral James Forrestal, who was the first Secretary of the Navy, had a document read to the men on the Antietam, claiming that, you know, because the morale was low, he wanted to go and just reassure them that things like the Philadelphia experiment had actually happened, and it was a document that he read. And according to Fred Tracy claimed that because of low morale, Admiral Forrestal issued a directive, and he said, quote, "It was then decided to stop the degaussing operation to see what was wrong. The ship could not be seen, although all the electrical cables could still be in a coil position as if being supported. The boat was not there, nor was there any member of its crew present. This is the Eldridge. At the Navy Yard, a mist appeared and grew heavy. Finally, the ship reappeared. When the boat was boarded, severe damage was found to the ship and terrible effects on the crew. Now, this was the narrative from Fred Tracy, as per the memo from Admiral Forrestal.
Now, was this an actual memo that one can see, or was this his recollection of a memo?
It's his recollection, and we had corresponded for the longest time, and I have all kinds of letters from him. I tried to track down crew members from the Antietam, but many of these guys have already passed, so I wasn't able to go and get any kind of confirmation what Fred Tracy said. But it gets interesting because with Tracy, the combination of Tracy and Admiral Forrestal allegedly was with the mysterious MJ-12 group.
He's listed in there in the documents, yeah.
Exactly. Now, supposedly this was a group thrown together to retrieve these crashed saucers, beginning with Roswell. And he was in that. The other thing that happened, Forrestal committed suicide. He was on suicidal watch, and he jumped out of a 16-floor window at the Bethesda Hospital in Maryland. And, you have to wonder, if you're on a suicidal watch, why would you put somebody on the 16th floor? Why not keep them down low on the first floor so they could be watched and kept safe? So it's
that's true. It doesn't make much sense. That argument, yeah.
Yeah. And we want to throw in this too, since we're talking about, some of the commonality, but with the Philadelphia experiment, Dr. Morris Jessup, Admiral James Forrestal, and Phil Schneider were all found dead, either suicide or homicide. So again, you have to ask yourself, what was going on with this? If it was a coincidence, it was just a, pretty weird coincidence that three of these main players, I would say, in this Philadelphia experiment narrative, died these mysterious deaths.
Well, Phil Schneider, though, he never said he was on the boat, right? What he was talking about was a later thing, and he sort of got his start through Al Bielek's thing. Al Bielek kind of introduced him and promoted him. It was kind of like a right?
Right, yeah. And, with this Philadelphia experiment, there's these twosomes, like I talked about Fred Tracy and Admiral Forrestal, but there's also Al Bielek and Phil Schneider. There was a preparedness expo out in California, I believe it was around 1998. And these are the end of the world people, the doomsday guys.
Yeah.
And so Al Bielek claimed that he was the one that pulled the trigger, pushed the button on the Eldridge that caused the Philadelphia experiment. And also, Schneider claimed that his father was a former U-boat captain that was assigned to the Eldridge. So both Bielek and Schneider both claimed that they had some connection to the Eldridge and the Philadelphia experiment.
That's true. Although there's a couple of significant things about Al Bielek, right?
and let's say this before we start going into whether or not he was truthful. Whenever you get on YouTube and listen to anything by Al Bielek, this guy comes across. He is articulate. He speaks the King's English. I believe he had a degree in engineering from Princeton. He talks the talk. He is articulate. He has good recall. He's a great communicator. He's taken the Philadelphia experiment into Montauk and further. And, his narrative gets a little bit bizarre when he starts talking about time travel and,
The thing with Al Bielek and his greatest gift, right, is that he could talk about this stuff and just sound so bored. He'd be making these speeches and he'd sound... Yeah, almost like an ASMR guy. He did George Norrie. He did
Art Bell.
The guy. Those guys really, kind of made him and put him over in a lot of ways. But the significant thing to me about Al Bielek is that he was in the cryptozoology scene and was friends with Ivan Sanderson.
Okay.
So he was a guy that was out there sort of doing the paranormal, like, milieu, mm-hmm. you know, doing the conventions, doing the meetups. Then he sees this movie, The Philadelphia Experiment, which is sort of like a Hollywood sort of you know, Hollywoodification of,
yeah.
of this sort of the yeah. legend that Carlos Allende had been promoting a while before that, and sort of, you know, I think the movie came out because Bill Moore wrote his book, right? Bill Moore book comes out in 79.
And yeah, Bill Moore experiment. And Charles Berlitz's book.
Berlitz, right.
Yeah,
right.
The dynamic duo. And the director, the most significant thing to me about the director of the Philadelphia Experiment is that he also made Mac and Me, which if you know Mac and Me, it's one of the most infamous E.T. knockoff films. And he made a bunch of sort of pretty cool low-budget movies. Mm-hmm. Philadelphia Experiment, if you were a latchkey kid in the 80s, was on cable all the time. And Adam,
that
I know
that was me.
Movie. That was me too. Yeah. 80s, you know, it was just on HBO around the clock when there was, like, you know, only, you know, a handful of channels on cable. So Bielek doesn't start talking about the Philadelphia Experiment until after the movie. And prior to that, he was just another paranormal guy, and that's the big red flag to me. And then he starts bringing in sort of like importing more and more mythology into it.
Yeah.
I can't remember, but when I was a child, I watched, it wasn't Outer Limits and it wasn't Night Gallery and it wasn't Twilight Zone, but it was a show like that, and they had a retelling of the Philadelphia Experiment on that. Even before,
maybe One Step Beyond.
It might have been One Step Beyond. It was shot in black and white, and I'll never forget the shots of the guys stuck into the hull. So
yeah,
uh-huh. Sort of like the fundamentals of the story of the Philadelphia Experiment were, like, really well worn by the time that Al Bielek gets into the mix. And, well, he's a great storyteller. You know, it's
a great storyteller, right?
Right. But yeah. But it sounds like if he was hanging around the sci-fi section at Crown Books, like I probably was around the same time.
Yeah, he said, you know, Philadelphia Experiment came out in 84. He said that he watched it in 85 and it jarred repressed memories. And he said, "Well, I was there." So that became his narrative, and that's what he started to talk about. And, you know, I mean, so he tells the story, then he starts talking about Montauk, but he was talking about all this time travel and going into the future and all these the narratives. I mean, he really pushed that card, that credibility, and
Bielek. One of the things that was said, well, you know, he pushed the button that did it, but he was a different guy. What did he, was it Duncan Cameron? Was that the
name? Yeah, right. Yeah.
And so then you get that like weird, like they age regressed him and sent him back in time so that he was old enough to be Al Bielek in the 90s when he was telling this story. And the age regression is elements of stuff that I've heard come from other people as well, that have said this. Like Corey Good has made that same pronouncement. Guy that we had on the show, Captain K, that claimed he was a Martian super soldier, who kind of, Corey Good said the same thing. I said that as well. So it seems like these are ideas that, like, were first kind of propagated by Al Bielek and some other people later on.
And Bielek had this wonderful resume, you know, engineer aboard the Eldridge, project manager or project director at Montauk. I mean, on and on and on. You know, he just got all these assignments. Yeah. All these assignments. So,
did you ever take a look at the Bielek debunked material on the web? Because one of the big things that they really pushed against was that he didn't have a degree at Princeton.
Okay.
Yeah. They and I think it was something like they determined that there was maybe like there was somebody named Duncan Cameron that went to Princeton, but it's like the picture is a different guy. I can't remember the exact details of it, but
I'm doing some research on him.
He's a really interesting cat because like he was sort of like floating around in the mix, you know, for kind of a while before he hit on this thing. And then I really think that he was just like the right thing at the right time, you know, because then you get the guys like Phil Schneider and you get Preston Nichols, right. And just people are just eating out of the hands, you know?
Yeah. And Snyder's and, you know, big thing, Snyder's big thing was really the Dulce bass. That was really his, that was his thing.
Right. Yeah,
Schneider,
I mean, all, but I feel like Al Bielek really kind of put him over in a lot of ways, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the problem once Preston Nichols gets in the mix, there's kind of a lot of stuff that sounds like not so above board with these guys. Sort of some of the Montauk related. Things that they're doing with other people that they're saying are former Montauk subjects and things like that. Mm-hmm. Some troubling stuff that they talk about in the books.
Yeah.
I look at just the possibility. And, you know, one thing that we should at least focus on, you know, we know that the CIA was experimenting with mind control and LSD. We know that the CIA dosed scientists. They dosed these Johns visiting prostitutes, you know, just a whole lot of things that's already in the record. And again, during World War II, we were doing everything we could to win that war. But mind control, you know, remote viewing was one of the things. And why not have an epicenter where maybe they were conducting experiments, and why not Montauk, you know, Fort Hero? So some of that makes sense. I mean, you know that we were doing that, you know, just pick a place. And, you know, some people felt that Montauk was that epicenter of mind control experimentations and all this other stuff. I don't know about the, you know, about the kidnapped, you know, kids and all that. But even, you know, for my home state of Pennsylvania, you know, we had Pennhurst. It was a mental asylum where they, just like tortured a whole lot of people, you know, children and prisoners and mentally ill. So, you know, we know that that was happening, and that was happening for a long time before they shut it down. So, you know, I'm just looking at, you know, some possibility. And again, I think a lot of this mythology, whether it's the Philadelphia Experiment or Montauk, there's a kernel of truth. And even, you know, you mentioned the Dulce Wars, you know, Schneider talked about the DUMs, the, what is it, deep underground military bases.
Right.
And supposedly throughout the world, there's all these bases under North Korea and Russia. You know, the old Soviet Union had their tunnels and their underground cities just in case. And Schneider was just saying that he was a an explosives technician, and they needed his services, and they went down there and they discovered the Grays, and, you know, they had the shootout. So you know, his narrative got a little bit freaky as well, but, you know, at least the beginnings of this makes sense to me, that they're probably are deep underground military bases, and God knows what's down there, you know. And
I think there's always a kernel of truth to all these things. I mean, I would agree that I think the Montauk was probably, there was probably some kind of mind control experiment or something that was going on there that later on just got blown out of proportion, possibly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And with you reporting about Mr. Tracy, that he was on another ship that was also did this degaussing experiment,
right,
about like a couple years later.
Yeah.
And that seems very possible and very valid to me.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you think about how there's been a lot of very much human experimentation, especially in the military. I mean, if you think about the nuclear veterans or the atomic veterans,
oh, having them look at the blast.
Yeah. Right. And the cancers and the issues that they have had, It is very similar to what Tracy is reporting with right. this degaussing experiment.
Right.
So it's entirely possible that they were doing this experiment. Whether the ship disappeared and was teleported to Norfolk or not, I don't know. But it's very possible that from those experiments, you get that's the kernel of truth, and everything just kind of builds from there.
Pretty likely, right? That they were, I mean, you know, that they would continue the degaussing experiments because there, at that time, you know, the hulls of those ships still had a magnetic signature.
Mm-hmm.
And so you'd still be trying to avoid, you know, underwater mines.
But where it starts is where the next thing I wanted to talk about was Morris K. Jessup and Carl Allen, otherwise known as Carlos Allende. Like, that seems to be where, I guess, for lack of a better term, the mythology kind of starts.
Yeah, and it got the attention of the military, too. Carl Allen.
Right.
Well, Carl Allen, or Carlos Allende, he was from New Kensington, Pennsylvania. And what he did was he got a copy of Morris Jessup's book, The Case for the UFO. And so he had all these annotations in different colors on the side of the book. And it looked like there were three different people talking about anti-gravity devices and all this. He sent one of these to the Navy, Office of the Naval Research. He labeled it Happy Easter. So the military called Jessup in, showed him this book, you know, with the annotations, and he goes, yeah, I've been getting all this stuff from this guy, Carl Allen. You know, I mean, he was getting like hundreds and hundreds of letters with these annotations. So the government just wanted to know if somebody knew something that they didn't, if they knew anything about anti-gravity devices, et cetera. What happened was, allegedly, Jessup allegedly found out the secret. He was going to go and reveal the secret to Dr. Valentine. And the night before they were going to have the meeting, they found him, they discovered his body in this parking lot in Miami. He had committed suicide. It looked like he ran a hose from the exhaust into the car and committed suicide that way. You know, some people felt that, you know, this was just that he was murdered. And there was a book called David Ritchie's book, UFO, The Definitive Guide to Unidentified Flying Objects and Related Phenomena. He said that he felt that Jessup was silenced because of what he knew. So, again, that's his conjecture. But it didn't seem to make sense because, according to this Dr. Valentine, Jessup had information that he was going to reveal. And, you know, the timing was pretty bizarre. I was able to contact the National Archives and Records Administration. There was a guy named Richard A. von Donhoff, and he wrote to me, responded. He said this about the Philadelphia experiment. This is his quote. As far as the Department of the Navy can determine, the fictitious story of the destroyer, USS Eldridge, from the Delaware River off the League Island Navy Yard to Hampton Roads, back in 1943, began as a practical joke among staff members of the Naval Research Laboratory here in Washington. The humorous commentary on a theoretical paper on electromagnetism got out of hand and soon achieved the status of fact and legend. The one thing that I get from this document, I mean, this isn't typical military Pentagon jargon. Usually that's very straight-laced and academic. But he throws things in like fictitious story, humorous commentary, practical joke. I mean, I don't know. I just, you know, we always talk about government cover-ups. This just seems to be another bit of denial, you know, about anything that might have happened. So, and that, again, that was from the National Archives and Records Administration.
Like I said, I think there's definitely a kernel of truth.
I know.
And like, yeah. Carl Allen, I don't think it was based on a practical joke or whatever.
Carl Allen was known to be prone to delusions, right?
Yeah, pretty much. They, you know, yeah. But even they talk about the mysterious Carl Allen, and supposedly he wasn't that mysterious, and he wasn't hard to track down and find. And So, but I think he had some issues, and I also think he was a bit of a hoaxer or a practical joker, and he took this as far as he could, and he kind of like single-handedly, scripted this Philadelphia Experiment narrative, and then Belak stepped in there and took it a little bit further.
You know, I always wondered if the what is it, the Vero version of the book, that's what they call it, with the three colors of ink.
Yes, right. Yeah.
I always wondered if that was some kind of sort of like spy communique or something, or that if the reason that official people maybe took interest in it is they were wondering if someone was passing messages. I don't know what that would be, but the way that it's written, you know, there's like a lot of strange turns of phrase and the color coding and things like that.
Yeah, that's a good theory. It's my understanding that the government just had a whole bunch of copies made, duplicated, I think down in Texas. And they were, and I think there's still, you could still buy those, I believe, on the, maybe
it's been
on
reproduced.
Amazon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was, I forget who, what office it was mailed to, but it was sort of like, it wasn't officially investigated maybe, but that some folks there took an interest in it, and just, it was kind of like a office mystery or something like that, that they wanted to find out exactly what all this stuff was.
Right. When they called Jessup in, I think there were just two officers that were there, two individuals that questioned him. And sure. I think it ended there. I don't think that they found anything, you know, of substance. So, but the story continued from there, and it started with Jessup, and certainly Fred Tracy added to it, and Belak and Schneider. And a lot of this centered around in Jessup's book about Albert Einstein's unified force theory, where he was trying to, unify magnetism and anti-gravity, into one force. And
well, what's your personal thoughts on it, Max? And what do you think? What do you think happened? Do you have any kind of personal theories or thoughts on the Philadelphia Experiment?
Yeah, I think that, during the war years, I think that there was just a tremendous number of experimentations that were happening pretty much at the same time. Philadelphia Experiment being one of them, the Manhattan Project, LSD and mind control experimentations. I mean, all that. I think a lot of this was happening, not only with us, but with the Germans and also with the Soviet Union. And a lot of this was maybe, off the books, off the record. You know, we talk right now about the black budgets, that you have clandestine, secretive government organizations that are funded, but it's really hard to go and connect the dots and find out who they are and where they are. And a lot of times, even with the, unidentified aerial phenomenon, some of those groups changed their name and became something else. So I think that something happened. I think there was an accident. I think something bad happened. And I think there was a lot of denial and cover up. And I don't believe that, Carl Allen claimed that he viewed the Philadelphia Experiment. He was a merchant marine and viewed that. But there are all these people that inserted themselves into the narrative for whatever reason. And certainly Carl Allen was one. Al Belak was one. I believe that Fred Tracy was truthful. I mean, I had time to spend time with him.
Yeah.
Listen to his narrative, and I have a whole collection of his, letters that he sent me, and that he sent to the government, and so he knew things. He has since passed, I do think that there was something that happened, and you know, we're getting drips and drabs of it, and you know, I don't know if we're being sent into a rabbit hole, into the wrong direction, but you know, certainly Al Bielak sort of hijacked the narrative, and you know, so I think something happened, but we don't know what exactly it was. I think it was a government experiment that that something happened. There was an accident, and you know, and that's about all we know. The motion picture was you know, more of a science fiction thing, and you know, but so that's what I think.
Yeah, and the role of Moore too, in the Berlitz book. I mean, because I don't think a lot of people before that book was published had even heard of the Philadelphia Experiment. Right. And of course, the success of that book is the reason why you have a few years later, you have the movie is made.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Berlitz and Moore also did this for Roswell too. I mean, you know, before, of course, Stanton Friedman did a certain amount of work on Roswell and really was the one who really investigated and everything, but it was Moore's and Berlitz's book. And Charles Berlitz, I think, really just lent his name to these things.
Mm-hmm.
Moore probably really was the one who really wrote the corpus of it. But I really think that those two things become popularized because of these kind of really popular books, and it feels like a lot of that is what kind of helps to muddy the waters. Like, how do you feel about that?
Well, I think that William Moore helped to muddy the waters. You know, yeah. I mean, he admitted that he was just spreading around disinformation from the government, and
right.
So how much of what William more research and wrote can we really believe? And I mean, when you know, what part of this was coming from the government? He claimed that he was getting information, and in exchange for this information, he would go and send out disinformation to the public. So that's I think there's something else here that he's hiding. I don't think he ever really told the complete truth, and I'm not sure what that is. It may be easier to confess that you're a government agent than to confess to the world that you're making things up and you're a liar. So, you know, it may be easier to do that more mysterious, you know, that spy versus spy. So I'm not quite sure what the truth is with William Moore, but
to be really pretty earnest in his interest and even, you know, when he sort of came out and admitted that he had been working with, you know, the Air Force Office of Intelligence people. He explained it was because he thought, you know, he was going to be getting access, but I'm not sure he was even in touch with those guys when they did Philadelphia Experiment Project Invisibility. Mm-hmm. I think that may have been something, you know, he had sort of met Berlitz in the late 70s, and I think they may have been researching the Roswell book at that point. I can't remember if it came out in 80 or 81.
Yeah, you're right. Maybe 80.
But the Philadelphia Experiment book came out in 79, so I'm not sure if they would have even been contacted by Rick Doty, because I think the like inciting event in that saga is Paul Benowitz seeing the unknown craft flying, you know, over the Air Force base in New Mexico. And that would have been winter of 79. And that's when the Air Force OSI sort of gets in the mix, if I'm remembering that series of events right.
Yeah.
The interesting thing to me is that, Moore was just kind of like this English teacher. And somehow I just can't remember gets hooked in with Berlitz, who already had sort of been publishing, he'd done books on like Atlantis and
he had a name already.
Yeah, he was sort of a, you know, class a lot like Brad Steiger, who ended up writing some Philadelphia Experiment books, and then they did they did the Bermuda Triangle book in 1980, I think, and then the Roswell book, if I'm
so
my chronology right. And the
Bermuda Triangle was 74, so that was first.
74? Wow.
And then Philadelphia Experiment was 79 and Roswell Incident was 80. So those were two.
Okay, yeah.
They were right on top of each other.
Yeah, that makes sense, I guess. Yeah, and the Bermuda Triangle book sold like millions of copies. There's a book warehouse near where I grew up, and I went there a lot during the pandemic because there was nothing to do, and there would always be at least five or six different copies of the Bermuda Triangle book on the shelf there.
Right. Yeah, those were popular consumption books. Like, I can remember going to my grandparents' house and seeing those books, like at least one of those books.
Yeah. Everybody was getting them out. Like a cultural thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
they were very popular consumption. But because of something like the Philadelphia Experiment, the book is really what kind of really sets it off. I don't think anybody had really, maybe around like the UFO circles, mm-hmm. you know, it was known about because of Jessup probably primarily.
Mm-hmm.
But after that book is written and published, and then the movie comes out, and then that's when, you know, it becomes part of kind of like the American mythology.
Yeah, and Jessup was one of the first to be talking about the ancient aliens. You know, he was there doing that before Eric von Däniken. So, you know, he adds a lot more to the whole tapestry of ufology. Interesting guy.
And I wonder too about Jessup. The mysterious death. Whoever he was on his way to see, it may not have even been about the Philadelphia Experiment, but the Philadelphia Experiment gets put into that because of Carl Allen's, you know, writings in mm-hmm. that book
mm-hmm.
that
mm-hmm.
he sends to Jessup.
Yeah. Jessup seems to have been a solid individual as far as, you know, his background and I think archaeology. Just a lot of things. I mean, he was an interesting guy. I mean, he has a interesting resume, and certainly one of the main players in this Philadelphia Experiment.
Yeah, for sure. It's an interesting story, and it kind of gets told and retold, and now I feel like people kind of forgotten about it just a little bit. It's not as like told very much anymore. Mm-hmm. But like with the Montauk stuff is really, I think, where it kind of really transformed into. And I think because of Al Bielek, and you've got quite of other people that have hit onto the Montauk.
Piled on material.
Yeah.
So how does that work? I mean, you have all these people stepping up, Richard Doty was one, and, Schneider.
Did Doty have anything to say about Montauk? I don't remember him coming in on that side of it. I think he was interested in promoting the sort of like underground base.
The Dulce Wars. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he kind of set that off.
And his connection with Paul Benowitz. I guess it was government disinformation there. So, and what exactly happened there? Are you guys familiar with that?
Yeah, it's a pretty well-worn tale. Paul Benowitz was a ufology fan. He started seeing strange things in the sky. He took some film of them. Those things may have been classified projects, he brought them to the Air Force because he was a veteran. He later sort of linked up with this guy at the Office of Special Investigations who, took some of those films from him, or someone took them on his behalf. And there was sort of a gradual sort of ramping up of, trying to sort of sow confusion with Benowitz about this, which mostly, you know, there's like a lot of episodes and a lot of intricacies and players in that story. You know, and Benowitz intersects with the 1979 cattle mutilation conference out in Colorado. He's there. You know, he knew Gabe Valdez. He knew Linda Howe. He knew, you know, all these people. Chris Lamprecht, David Perkins, that whole crew.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, he's just kind of like in the mix there, and he got caught up, you know, and sort of swept up by Doty and the people Doty was working with. You know, there's a couple really interesting things about his case, but, you know, I don't know. That's sort of a separate, separate convo. Yeah. The other thing, you know, Jessup did commit suicide. But I think it's worth a note, because mental health is a, you know, a real thing that, in 1958, Morris Jessup's wife left him. I think he was having, he like, moved from New York to Florida at that point. He was, you know, his friends were felt that he was unstable. He might have been having some troubles with work, you know. I think he was trying to make a living publishing UFO books, but there's kind of a low ceiling on that,
right?
So a lot of people that knew him at the time said that the suicide wasn't entirely out of nowhere. And so I want to, I personally feel like I want to say, I think he just killed himself.
Yeah. Okay.
That's
yeah.
One, you know, we love a mysterious death in the UFO scene, but I think maybe Morris Jessup was just having a bad life.
Mm-hmm.
He unfortunately was depressed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But you know, it's something that adds to it. It adds to the mythology, right? It adds to the something conspiracy.
Yeah. Well, because the thing that adds is that there's like no real good ends for any of these people. You know, Carl Allen had, you know, mental health issues. Morris Jessup had mental health issues. Paul Benowitz had mental health issues.
Admiral Forrestal.
Forrestal had mental health. He was dosed, right?
No, you're thinking about another case.
Losing my UFO guy card.
Right? No, Forrestal was the secretary of the Navy.
Who
jumped out of the
had a nervous floor. Breakdown, and then they put him in. Yeah, you know, maybe that's something. I mean that's a popular one.
Mm-hmm.
I think the thing about the Philadelphia experiment specifically that's enticing is that it was so easy. It was sort of like a an open source mythology that people one of the first ones in the UFO scene that sort of anybody could started jumping into and being like, oh, I have something, you know, Al Bielek. And now there's a few of those, and we've sort of like we've heard them all before, right? But the sort of like adventure story element to it, you know, like the way that Al Bielek tells it, it's like a comic strip from the 1940s or something. and I think that there's like something appealing about that, especially like when he first sort of came out with it, and I think that's why it sort of endured for a while. It was like a regular thing on the circuit.
Mm-hmm. Did anybody ever call him on that? Any of the?
Yeah, I mean, well, there was a website, like I said a little earlier, called Bielek Debunked, and they like systematically just went through his life, like you know, had like gone and researched the background about him, and you know,
and he didn't go to Princeton,
like a guy that liked to tell a yarn, you know. You know, he's such a like older gentleman at that point anyway, that he kind of just seemed like he was just looking for something to do.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that I always remember is when he talks about going to like the 23rd century or what, there's like a part in the story where he's like talking about being in a hospital bed. And he's talking about the TV in the hospital where he spends like a bunch of time describing like the TV and like the TV shows in the floating city that he's staying in this space age. It's like such a strange thing to insert into your story for credibility.
Yeah, he was talking about the New World Order. He was his rant about the future was almost like an anti-socialist thing, you know, talking about the robots and the humanoids that were specially designed and all that. You know, so he had an interesting narrative, you know, the floating cities and all.
Well, it was odd though, right? Because he was like, like for instance, like he was helped by socialized healthcare in his story. So he was talking about it as like a one world government, sort of like, I guess like quasi socialist, power structure. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And he's sort of like describing it as dystopian, but also he's like, you know, I got all this free medical care and like, they took care of me. And like, I wasn't, you know, like a lot of times when people make up these sort of far-fetched stories about traveling to the future, like they don't get like a cushy hospital stay.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's like a really like interesting and kind of funny subversion, especially in that scene with people like, you know, not too far removed from like the Patriot movement and things like that. People who are, you know, warning you about that one world government.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be like sort of maybe by accident or maybe on purpose, sort of making the socialist utopia seem okay, all things considered.
Mm-hmm.
Well, here's a question. I kind of like to end it with you with this, Maxim. You know, you've just published not too long ago a book about UFOs, and how do you feel like something like the Philadelphia Experiment or some of the themes, how do you feel like it fits in with the broader theme, broader ufological field, and are these themes that you have seen in some of your other stories that you've possibly written about in that book?
Yeah, the new book is called Flying Saucer Esoteric, The Altered States of Ufology. And I think it all fits in, you know, because I take a look at the narrative of contactees, abductees, hoaxers, scientists, you know, planetary travelers. And what I do is I take a look at folks starting with the days before Christ, and some of whom were viewed as heretics because they believed that Earth was the center of everything, whereas the church believed that God had ordained that it was the sun. You know, so some of these folks were viewed as heretics and put to death. But I take a look at it through all the years and then end with the 2023 congressional hearings, UFO hearings with David Grush, and which is interesting. You know, like I watched, that was in July of 2023, and I was up in a radio station being interviewed. So we had that tape. So we went home and watched that. But, you know, I was excited about it. I thought maybe there's going to be some government transparency. We're going to get to the end of this and find out once and for all. So what Grush did was he said that he knows where the bodies are. He knows where the biological entities are. He knows that Mussolini captured a saucer, got a saucer, gave it to the Vatican, and then the United States got the craft from the Vatican. So that's all well and done and great. But where's the proof? I mean, where's the accountability, and when's the government or somebody going to say, okay, you know, you already mouthed off about this. Now tell us, show us your cards. I mean, show us your cards. I'm like, we've come this close to the truth, or what we think is the truth, and then there's nothing. It's almost like this big buildup, and then nothing. And so, you know, I'm like everybody else, waiting for the next chapter where somebody will go and let us know where this leads. And Grisha's saying, well, it's classified, and I can't reveal the information unless it's with certain entities and certain government people. So, you know, why don't we make this happen? And, you know, enough of this already. You know, I mean, we could go and have the information tomorrow. So, you know, I don't know who's zooming who, you know, who's lying and distorting and, you know, all that, you know, but there's more out there, and I'd like to go and find out what that is.
Okay. Yeah. Chris, I want, and when we're during the outro, I'd like to talk a little bit about Grish as well, but, you know, because he's an interesting character.
Yeah. And at the same time, we had the Mexican corpses, you know, that Jaime Musan revealed those, you know, from Peru. So it's the same thing. And, you know, he wheeled them out, and the Mexican scientific community was pushing back. And a lot of people were, you know, and with science, what you do is, you know, when we get the moon rocks, we break them up and we give them to scientists around the world so they can all take a look at them and see what's in there. So we could all compare notes at the same time. You know, we're not doing that with the Mexican corpses, with those aliens. So he's keeping them to himself. So, you know, that's a red flag.
He's an incredible carnival barker. He has a gift.
Yeah, that's what he's been doing.
What's your favorite UFO story? I'm just curious. Do you have a favorite?
Oh, yeah. Of course, you know, being from Pennsylvania, it's Kecksburg.
Okay.
That's the Pennsylvania Roswell. And the interesting thing with that, you know, so something came down, the military took it out of town under, you know, cover of darkness. And then with all these people like Stan Gordon, all these people using the Freedom of Information Act to try to find out what that was, all the information is either lost or redacted. So why? I mean, if it was a crashed Soviet craft, if it was one of ours, you know, whatever. I mean, why? Where's the information? Why the you know, what I would call the cover up? So you know, somebody's not being truthful with that. But we haven't gotten very far with Kecksburg, and you know, and a lot of people have been trying. So, you know, I don't know what happened there, but anyway, the very interesting narrative. And then some people took it a little bit further, that it was the Nazi time machine bell. So that the story got, just when you thought that Kecksburg was over with, you know, we get another chapter or two that, you know, makes it even crazier. So,
yeah, I think that was Joseph Farrell, I think, that came up with that.
But was it the Clark bell?
Yeah, because he wrote a book about the Nazi bell thing, and, you know, drew some comparisons to that kind of weird acorn shape that the Kecksburg, whatever that it was, that landed in Kecksburg.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Stuart Raffel is still alive, director of the Philadelphia Experiment, Ice Pirates, and Mac and Me. And I just think he could make a great Kecksburg Nazi bell movie.
You know, he did Ice Pirates too.
Yeah, he did. Excellent. What a resume. You know what? And Tammy and the T-Rex. Do you know Tammy and the T-Rex?
Yes.
Where they put the brain. Like, this guy is a filmmaking legend.
So he was the director for the Philadelphia Experiment, right?
Yeah.
For the movie.
Yeah. He made the movie. I think he could make a Kecksburg Bell Nazi Bell movie.
I'd go see it.
At least as good as Mac and Me.
Yeah.
Well, on that point, Maxim, it's been great to have you back. This is kind of a short and sweet little discussion on Philadelphia Experiment, but we are going to have you on to talk about your UFO book. But please tell people where they can find your books and where they can find you.
Yeah. Well, first, Adam and Chris, thanks so much for having me back. And I wish there was more meat, and I wish there was more, you know, substance and data, but it is what it is. But I have a website. It's www.maximfurek.com. That's MAXIMFUREK. And if anybody would be interested in any autograph books, they could contact me. Or, of course, you could contact Jeff Bezos at Amazon and buy them from him, because Jeff needs the money. So, anyway,
right.
But Coal Region Hoodoo is my previous book, and the latest one is Flying Saucer Esoteric, The Altered States of UFOlogy. So check it out. And thanks so much, and keep up the good work. This was a great narrative, yeah. And you guys know your stuff. And
thank you.
No, thank you so much. Thanks for sharing your knowledge as well.
Nice to meet you.
It's been great to have you on. And definitely whenever you we'll have you on soon to talk about the UFO. It's called UFO Esoteric.
Flying Saucer Esoteric.
Flying Saucer Esoteric. Even better.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, guys. This is great. I really appreciate it.
Excellent. We'll stay on the line with us. We're just going to close out this section. And guys, Chris and I will be back right after this little break. All right, guys, welcome back to Conspiranormal. Interesting discussion with Max and Furyk there about the Philadelphia experiment. You've been interested in the Montauk stuff for a while, so primarily, but Philadelphia experiment and Montauk kind of just go together.
It's a classic internet 1.0 kind of like urban legend, right?
Yeah.
That's like you go to like some website where like the background is all gray and you like read about it, you know, when you're a teenager. Well, that's what I did anyway. Yeah. So I have a soft spot for it. I wish the more fantastical stuff, you know, I love all that, but it's pretty made up.
Yeah. I remember, I didn't even know who he was at the time, but I can remember. It was late 90s. I was just hanging out in my room or something, listening to Coast to Coast. And this guy's on, you know, of course, you turn it on like midway, right? It's already going on. And this guy's talking about, oh, I was on the ship and I jumped off the ship and I ended up in 1983.
Yeah.
And it was 1943, but I ended up in 1983 and I had to go back. And I'm like, this is the movie.
Yeah.
This guy is saying it's basically the movie. And of course, Art Bell is just over there, just eating it up, you know, you know, and it's just, you know, it's like, you already knew if you grew up watching the movie, which I think that like, he must not have counted that too many people saw that movie,
which is crazy.
But then he said, like you said, that once people confronted him about it, I guess he said, "Oh well, when I watched the movie, it all came back to me, right?"
Yeah.
And of course, his whole thing was that he was this other person. Named Duncan Cameron, I think.
Yeah.
Like he was this other person and he knew all about what really happened. And so they age regressed him to a baby, which they could apparently do in the 1940s, which you can't do now. But anyway, so they age regressed him to a baby, sent him back in time to be, and he assumed the identity of Al Bielek, but in 1984 or 5, he's watching HBO and the Philadelphia Experiment movie comes on and he's all of a sudden, it jogs his memory. And, you know, of course the 1980s, you know, this is the classic time of like repressed memories and this type of thing too. So.
Sure. And cool. I mean, you know, I guess they're probably, you know, if you want to go with the sort of the classic conspiratorial slant, you know, there's a lot of people claiming that they were a part of experiments in the 60s and 70s and the 50s, 60s, 70s who are only just remembering those things. And then you've also got on top of that, you have the people you know, the Michelle remembers satanic
cult
stuff. And then on top of that, you have the abduction panic.
Right.
So it just, everybody has a repressed memory in the '80s.
Yeah.
So that sort of also sort of makes Al Bielek really dubious to me, because he's coming around after all of that, after all the other repressed memory people.
Well, then the Montauk stuff starts.
Yeah.
Right.
At some point,
Al Bielek becomes part of that. And who are the other guys?
Preston Nichols is the main
guy. Preston Nichols, yeah.
And he is actually a really interesting guy, because, you know, I'm like reaching over. I've got my Montauk books here, but he's like a, you know, some kind of a like amateur, like a ham radio mad scientist kind of dude. And he's starts saying, well, I remember being there too. And I was also working at Montauk as a scientist. And, you know, it's been like a little while since I really like sponged up absorbed all the media, the Montauk literature, as it were.
Right.
But he starts like taking people out to the base and giving them tours, and none of the buildings were blocked off or boarded up at that point. And this is like the early 90s. And so there's even a video. I think he took like a Japanese film crew out there, and you can find the video on YouTube. And it's actually, it's a really, it's almost like, you know, in the video camera of like Laura Palmer and stuff, it almost has that quality to it when you're watching, like really hypnotic kind of stuff. But he's going around and he's saying, oh yeah, that's the, you know, the seismic generator with the, you know, Johnson coil that does the, you know, whatever, you know, created the monster that I, you know, just going around and sort of like pointing at different, and I'm like, you're looking at it and it's like, that just looks like any, you know, like a generator or any sort of like power source thing that would be on a military base. So and him and another guy who kind of get involved, and they start doing these like regressions on boys that are supposedly coming to them and saying that they think they might be a Montauk experiment. And there's
the Montauk boys,
the really heavy sexual element to that is uncomfortable. Yes. Right, because the thing that they said is they designed this Montauk chair and they would sit people in it and it would push them to a orgasmic, like achieving climax point, and then when they were at that point, they could use the chair to create things with their mind, or, you know, do all these other like bizarre sci-fi things. But there's this sort of questionable aspect of like what these guys were doing in the real world, where they were working with like younger men, possibly underage. I don't know. I know that's like, I don't know, maybe you want to edit this out. But they were sort of doing these like weird regressions. And I'd have to find, there's some articles about it, but where the guys would sort of like strip down to their underwear and be like hypnotized and meditate with Preston and I forget who the other guy
is. it gets weird and it gets disturbing real quick.
It's really like it's questionable. Like you really have to wonder.
It's extraordinarily questionable. Well, and there's this other guy that gets involved later, and Stuart Swerdlow.
Yeah, and that he had a feud with some of them, I think.
Yeah.
You know, the impression that I got was that he kind of like he came in and was like, oh yeah, me too. I'm also one of the time traveling, you know, super soldiers. And then he started adding stuff into the story, and they were like, "Whoa, whoa, wait a minute! Like this is our grift. Like, get out of here." And so they had some friction with each other. Like, he's the guy who said that they send him back in time to get the blood of Christ to like make an army of Jesus clones to.
I seem to remember this. Yeah,
do something. I mean, it just.
Why would you need to do that when you just get the blood from the Shroud of Turin?
Why indeed, Adam? Well, it was something like first they send him back to kill Jesus so that they could clone him. And then he like got there, you know, at the crucifixion, and he's like, I can't do it. You know, so he comes back. And so then they send him back, and he just gets blood out of the side wound.
There you go. Practical.
Yeah, no, of course.
That reminds me of Andrew Basiago.
Same.
Who came out, you know, later, not connected with any of this stuff. Well, I guess peripherally. But like he was saying that, like, you know, he was sent back in time because he was on Mars with Barack Obama.
Yeah.
And he was sent Barack Obama was a part of this, guys. He was sent back in time to give Abraham Lincoln a message at the Gettysburg Address, and like he actually took this old like Matthew Brady picture, and like points to this little kid, and he's like, see, that's me, you know. And I remember like he was on Jesse Ventura's show like back like 10 years ago or 15 years ago, and they're driving by this house, right, with this guy. And he says, this is where I lived in 1973 and 1974, but not exactly in that order.
Oh, my God. These people, you know, the sad thing is none of them are really that good at making up tall tales.
Yeah.
Like, you know, because if you listen to those old Al Bielek broadcasts, they're so boring. Like, he's saying the most fantastical stuff you've ever heard, but he's doing it like he's telling you about, like, you know, a day working at the supermarket. It's just so boring.
Yeah. Well, then I was age regress, you know, and that happened, and they sent me back through the time tunnel, and then I.
You know who did a pretty good Philadelphia Experiment series was Aaron Golias. He sort of did it in his very in the way that he does, but he really like pulled all the sort of elements and streamlined it into something that you can follow. And it was like a few episodes that
it was three parts. He did three parts on it. He did and he includes the Montauk material in there as well.
Right, he did job sort of culling the various strains of bullshit and making, you know, weaving them into one bullshit tapestry.
And then he said he was done with it after that.
Wouldn't you be?
Yeah.
I mean, let's see, what books do I have? I have this, the Brad Steiger, Al Bielek book, Brad Steiger with Alfred Bielek and Sherry Hansen Steiger. This one is pretty bad. You know, and it goes into it of course it has a chapter on the Darrows. It's not even all, it's like they didn't have enough Philadelphia Experiment. The good thing is it has the, it has some of the classic, Wes Crumb illustrations in it from those comic books and from the Tim books, you know. So you get that in here. And then I have a couple of the Preston Nichols with Peter Moon books, and these are just bad sci-fi. I mean, it's all bad sci-fi, but this is like you know, Montauk Experiments in Time, Montauk Revisited, Adventures in Synchronicity. This is just silly stuff. And then I have this Montauk Files one that doesn't have any of the sort of major players involved in it, but it has more pictures of the base itself than most of these other books. have. And it's, I mean, I think this is from the early 90s. I think when I was on the show with you once, I talked a lot about this book.
I think so, yeah.
Because it's like the only one that's sort of, well, you can't say it's factual, but it's not like built around a personal narrative like these other ones are, I guess. And that's the distinction, at least. At least you can just look at these insane claims as they are, and there's not like this sort of whistleblower, storyteller narrative around it. But
and you've gone there, right? You've actually gone Montauk, and
it's open. It's a national park. You can't get any of those buildings anymore, but you can look in the window and see, you know, like, I don't know, man. You know, people have taken pictures inside that one building with like the weird wallpaper and stuff. And maybe they were dosing people with psychedelics there, I guess. It would be a good place to sort of do something secluded like that. And, you know, maybe that's why the folklore sort of sprung up around it. You know, you're like 3 hours from New York. So if you pick up a runaway or a young kid who's a hustler at that time, you know, on 42nd Street, you put them in a van, drive them out to Montauk. For all they know, they're in Kansas, you know, like, I guess if we're going to go with that narrative, maybe there's some plausibility there, but I don't know. You know, I'm sure things like that happened at that time. There seems to be, you know, some kind of coherence to the stories that you hear about this again and again, but I don't know, you know, and it gets dark quick. So it takes a lot to sort of sit down and start to try and like sift through that and see what's really there. So,
dude, let's switch gears before we stop here.
Sure, yeah.
I wanted to get your thought. What's that?
On to lighter topics.
Yeah, well, sort of, I guess. what's your thoughts on Dave Grish?
Does he have anything new to say since July? You took one for the Conspiranormal team, and you tuned into his Joe Rogan interview, right?
Well, I haven't finished it. I mean, I've gotten as of when we're recording, I got like halfway through, but I think I probably got the meat of it. I mean, honestly, when Grush came out, your first impression is who is this guy? And then your second thought is anything that he is saying is true? Now, is it true because he's the one that's lying, or not true because he's the one that's lying, or is it true that it from the people that he's, is it a lie from the people that he's getting it from? Are they telling him, are they giving him a line? Because he's not said that he has seen anything himself, and he's maintained this, but it's all about the people that he's talked to. And he's very, you know, he went into like, he's intelligence. I mean, he has an extensive intelligence career, and just like somebody like Lou Elizondo, who's the same, it's hard to really, if you studied anything about UFOs and the misinformation, because we talked about Benowitz and we talked about Doty, and it seems like this is probably more of the same, but what's the reason? What's the point? I mean, you know, he just, and he's very, in the interview, he's very cagey and very careful about everything that he's saying. And it's like, so you can't say anything, but you're going on all these interviews, and it's also interesting to me that he has come out and said, unlike somebody like Lou Elizondo, like, he's coming out and saying that he's a whistleblower, that he's doing this out of the kindness of his heart, because he wants the world to know that UFOs are real, UAP or whatever are real, and that the world should know, and that he's suffering because of it. I mean, essentially, like, he's Daniel Ellsberg or somebody like that. But it's like he just, but I feel like he's just, that's just a role that he's saying that he's fulfilling. And he's talking about in the interview, talking to like Harry Reid, and, you know, and Reid had that long association with Robert Bigelow. I mean, it just feels like this is more of the Bigelow camp, that this is where the shit is coming from.
Yeah. Well, so like a couple things about this guy. So one, it seems like the reason that he's whistleblowing is because he feels like he's in danger, right? Like, that's his reasoning for it?
I don't know. I didn't really catch that. I mean, he said that he's been threatened before.
Yeah, so early on, talking a lot about like threats and things like that.
Right.
And I think that's interesting. Because to me, that says, well, to me, one thing that suggests is that he's saying, like, he's making himself a public figure now. So he's, I don't know if maybe he's mixed up in something else, or there is something that he was being threatened about, and he made the decision to like be public whistleblower. Maybe it's all in service of keeping him in the public eye so that he feels a little safer, so that he feels like someone can't hurt him. I don't know. That's just conjecture.
Yeah.
Another thing that I thought is, I remember when the Halloween 2018 reboot movie came out. You remember this movie, the first one of these new string of Halloween movies?
Yeah.
Somebody I was listening to or talking, I don't know, they sort of like systematically talked about each plot point in the movie, and because it was supposed to be a new movie that did away with all the old movies, right? This is
right.
They went through and sort of pointed out which plot elements were from which of the old movies that they were supposedly tossing to the curb. And when I was hearing the Grouch dude talk, first I was just like, well, every single like line of this story is just something else from another thing. And I think like everybody's sort of accepted that now, but like he's just recycled like a bunch of classic plot elements. I haven't heard one thing that he said that sounds any different from like what, I mean, it's not that different from like the Bob Lazar story. It's not that different from, you know, even something like what Stan Friedman was putting out there. It just doesn't seem like there's anything that he has to share that,
right,
all that different, but there's a lot of people who maybe don't know that.
Right. Yeah, a lot of younger people probably don't know that.
I would say a lot of people in Congress too.
Yeah.
One thing that I thought about Elizondo, and that maybe I think about this guy, I don't know if some of this is like being used as kind of like a gateway drug to pull in people that lean right, people that are like anti-government type. And I don't know to what end. I don't know if it's like they want to redirect some of those people who maybe are like, you know, off on the far right to sort of like chase the dragon of the, you know, unattainable UFO thing. Or
that's interesting. Maybe, yeah.
On the flip side, I mean, like, again, I don't have any proof of this. I'm just speculating. Well,
you know, Tucker Carlson takes a real interest in it.
Well, there you
shows
go.
Shows up on his show a lot, you know.
Tucker Carlson. So is speaking to that audience.
Yeah, so there might be some elements of that. That's very possible.
On the other hand, it could be a thing where, you know, UFO stuff, I think other people have talked about. I mean, I think Nathan was talking about this at the Strange Realities conference, that like sort of the UFO topic has been used as a recruiting tool into sort of like right wing limited government kind of groups, right?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I don't know who Grush is sort of tied up with. I'm sure if he's an intelligence agent, he's mixed up in all kinds of weird things that would, you know, make my head spin just in terms of how complicated they are. But
yeah, he is an intelligence agent.
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just there. Well, there seems to be no question about that.
Right.
And so, I don't know. You know, I don't know if there's like enough to read between the lines on this yet. I don't know if I don't know.
When this whole thing dropped in the middle of the year, it was like mostly it was like Leslie Keen was behind it. There was somebody else that was also, you know, that they were all this excited. We have this guy. We have this whistleblower that is going to blow the lid off of everything. And then the next question is, well, did he actually see these things? Well, no. He's been told these things by other people. And then you get to the hearing, and he gives his testimony. And then there's questions that he can't answer unless he goes to a different room, but not on camera. And it just kind of was like a dud. And you don't really hear from him for a few months. And now he's making the podcast rounds. He's on Joe Rogan.
Well, if he's doing the podcast rounds, to me, that also suggests that like any sort of official engagement with him is probably done.
That might be true.
Joe Rogan, if you're having meetings with people on Capitol Hill.
But as a whistleblower, like he's saying, but even as a whistleblower, he's saying things that, like, I don't know. I feel like you're going to be a whistleblower. You're going to be like, okay, you're going to reveal what you know.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Even if it's on like media. But he's not doing that. He's like still kind of just like, well, I can't tell you what that is. I have to be careful about what I say. Not, you don't see many whistleblowers that say those type of things.
Right.
I mean, Daniel Ellsberg, I mean, I bring him up, reveals the Pentagon Papers. Was Daniel Ellsberg after that cagey about what was in the Pentagon Papers? No. You know, so it does. I don't know. Just things like that just don't make any real sense to me. You know, he seems like he's talking about how, like, I was just kind of muttering to myself when he's talking about how I've just really lost a lot, and I've really just like financially I've taken a hit, and I'm thinking, don't worry, Dave, I'm sure you're set, bro.
Yeah,
I'm sure somebody's bankrolling this guy.
Yeah. I mean. The story that he's telling is pretty clearly not the whole story. It is interesting that he got access to like a full, you know, congressional sort of, you know, I don't know, a hearing or whatever.
Oh yeah.
I don't know what exactly to make of that. I don't know why. I don't know why you wheel that guy out and do that. I feel like Leslie Kane was, you know, sort of the useful idiot in this scenario, because whatever's going on is her getting more, and that whole cadre, you know, because it's not just Leslie Kane getting played and getting sort of positioned into whatever it is this guy's doing, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, bottom line, he hasn't said, you know, there's some interview where he was talking about alien bodies and things like that, but again, like, hadn't seen them, didn't have any specifics. It's just all like awfully vague. There's not like an inciting incident that he's pointing to. You know, it's not like, I don't know, it's not like he has like a Cash Landrum or something like that, that he can be like, see, this is how I know, you know, I have the right documentation on this, you know, whatever that was.
Yeah, he's got this weird story about the Mussolini finding the UFO in 1933.
Actually, I take it back. That's a good one. And
that is a good one. I feel like I've heard it before, though.
Yeah, he's not
somewhere.
Vaguely familiar.
But then the next thing is like his other big thing is, oh, Lockheed Martin has materials.
I mean,
well, I've heard that material shit multiple times now.
30 years at least, if not longer.
Yeah.
The
metamaterials.
I mean, okay. So the metamaterials, like, that refers to that New York Times article, right? And that's sort of become the shorthand for anytime anybody says they have like a little, you know, a little ball or flake of unknown material recovered at a supposed UFO crash site or whatever. But before that, you know, and what it usually turns out to be is someone says, I had, you know, one flake of this this unknown piece of metal analyzed, and it's a remarkably pure alloy that we don't have the capacity to produce on Earth without spending some like insane exorbitant amount of, you know, trillions of dollars to like make it.
Mm-hmm.
That's my understanding of like what those things are usually talking about. And so the question, you know, for people that are trying to study it is like, well, all right, so like where does this like impossibly pure thing come from if we can't make it on Earth, you know, air quotations. But he's talking about, you know, what he's saying is that there's like, I mean, I believe he said there were like fully intact spaceships or whatever, you know,
yeah,
you know, interdimensional, which, you know, the way these people talk about it is like fucking Rick and Morty or something, right? Like, it's just like, oh, I don't know, a flying machine came through a portal in the sky and
yeah,
from another dimension. Like, what is that? That doesn't mean anything.
Joe Rogan asked him at one point, says, what do you think the nature of these are?
Yeah.
And he really pays, because I think there is a recognition in the ufological community or whatever that is, that there's a real recognition that alternative non-ETH theories have gained ground in the last 10 years.
Yeah, sure.
And so Grish is like throwing out Jacques Vallée, and he's throwing out interdimensional things, and he's throwing all that stuff out there of what that is. So they're like, you know, he's just saying non-human intelligence, you know, he really kind of like hedging their bets on like what we're actually dealing with.
Sure. I mean, that, and why not? But also the way, if you really want to have that conversation, I guess it needs to be, you know, I guess it's more sophisticated than Joe Rogan asking, well, what is that?
Oh, man. Yeah, right.
Like, if you're talking about other dimensions, like it just seems like the way that people in UFO land talk about that is like, it's like Al Bielek talking about time travel. Like, it just sounds fake. It sounds like it's from a movie, you know. I don't really think that like the way that we're sort of like modeling other dimensions. It's not just like, you know, my house is the same, but, you know, like the colors are different or something like that, you know, or there's an exact copy of me in this other place. That seems like just too simple and silly. And so I don't know, when guys like this start talking about things like that, I just kind of I just got a chuckle.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, great discussion. I want to thank you for being a part of this tonight. And Sir Fiel should be back next week. But thank you so much for filling in and filling in the spot tonight.
Yeah, I'm a Conspiranormal is very dear to me, both of you guys.
Thank you.
Happy to spend a Tuesday night chatting about all kinds of made up and real stuff.
Excellent. All right. Well, thank you, Chris, for being a part of this. And guys, I want to also thank Maxim Furyk for coming on tonight. We're going to have about two or three more episodes, I think, through the rest of the year. One of which is going to be the year in review, but coming up, we're going to have Drew Hurst Beeson going to talk about Yuba County 5 and Zodiac Killer, and probably talk a lot about D.B. Cooper as well, who he thinks D.B. Cooper is. So that's another one. And then finishing off the year, like we always do, will be Dr. Future to give us his predictions and his thoughts for 2024 and 2023. So, but also guys, Conspiranormal Patreon, that is available. Hopefully we get into Patreon. Been real kind of lack some new Patreons lately, but that will hopefully change fairly soon, especially as we're getting into the new year. But if you guys want to contribute to us, if you like what we do, that is www.patreon.com/conspiranormal. And guys, we will see you on the next episode.